and choose Dilaudid over heroin. What was the deal with Swim? He kept changing his mind. He seemed to have six different minds. Then I realized, someone who isn't me. It was the name everyone used. One Swim said the Dilly Rush could literally knock you down. Another put a blotter under his tongue so he could save the rest of his saliva for later. Maybe someone who wasn't him could get a little high from what was left. Another Swim loved his first fentanyl high so much he decided to write about it on the Dilaudid thread. He posted the play-by-play of his second time. Swim is starting to feel more and more stoned. Unfortunately, his whole body doesn't feel like it's glowing of warmth like it felt with the previous experience with fentanyl. Swim is feeling more happy and content, but not enough in his opinion. I imagined someone who wasn't me sitting there one night, all alone with her computer and her disappointing high, faithfully narrating it for a world of strangers. When Amy Winehouse was getting high or drunk, the paparazzi photos always tried to zoom in as close as possible on her cuts and bruises, the residue of her benders. These little wounds were like openings in the tent flaps of her privacy. It was as if the photos were trying to get inside the wounds themselves, the closest thing to fucking her that the camera could possibly manage. After she died, one journalist reflected that her death forced the public to choke a bit on the rock mythology that's been crammed down our collective throats. The tortured genius, the hellion libertine, the martyr dying for the noble cause of nihilism. It was unending, our collective fascination with the self-inflicted pain of a beautiful woman. It was another incarnation of Elizabeth Hardwick's awe at Billie Holiday's luminous self-destruction, though it was Holiday who'd said, "If you think dope is for kicks and for thrills, you're out of your mind." If only that were true, but I've always perked up at drunkologues. The night Amy Winehouse won 5 Grammys, she told her friend Jules, "This is so boring without drugs." The answer on the Narco Farm intake form had stated it so simply, reason for addiction, to avoid monotony of living. My dad had always been irritated by the ways my high school human development class seemed to whitewash the truth. "How can they keep you from getting into trouble with drugs," he said, "if they aren't honest about how good they feel?" He always told me that one of the most dangerous things about drugs was the fact that they were illegal. This from a man born in 1943, the same year as George Kane, who never did time for the drugs he did, but knew that others had. It's not that there aren't thrills. It's just a question of aftermath. Holiday might have continued, "If you think dope is for kicks, then think of a woman spreading foundation on the sores across her face, asking her bodyguard why she's not getting her period, as Winehouse did after years of boozing and bulimia, when she was utterly cloistered by her fame and by her using, her body battered. She wasn't just a legend, but also a woman who couldn't walk straight, a woman on a bed who wasn't sleeping, but gone. When she died, her blood alcohol content was 0.4%, a level well above deadly. The coroner ruled it death by misadventure." Dope never helped anyone sing any better, Holiday insisted, though it's true that if Winehouse had gone to rehab that first time, we might never have gotten Back to Black, the album that made her famous. I wonder what we would have gotten instead. She had the complete gift, said her idol, Tony Bennett. If she had lived, I would have said, life teaches you, really, how to live it, if you live long enough. I would have loved to hear Amy Winehouse sing sober. Not just 2 weeks sober, but 3 years sober, 20 years sober. I never lived her life, and she never lived mine. But I know that when I was 27, I stopped, and when she was 27, she died. I know that when I watch a video of her on stage in Belgrade, drunk out of her mind, like she's been airdropped into a moment she can't possibly fathom, I think of coming out of a blackout into the strange new world of a Mexican bathroom stall, or a dirt basement in Cambridge, or a breezeless bedroom in Nicaragua, where it was easier to let a man finish fucking me than to stop him. When she lurches across that Belgrade stage and finally squats there, still and quiet, smiling, just waiting for something to happen or for something to stop happening, it's less that I know what's happening in her and more that her eyes know something that happened in me. I hate that she didn't have years of ordinary coffee dates and people saying, I get that, that she stayed doomed to her singularity and her vodka-thinned blood and her drunken stumbling under the broken tower of her beehive, her body barely holding up the weight, until it wasn't, until it couldn't any longer. Alone in my new apartment, I was constantly imagining Dave in his new apartment across town. I'd ended things because I was sick of obsessing about the exhausting question of whether we should be together. But now that we weren't together, I only obsessed about us more. It was a familiar vein of disappointment. I'd stopped drinking so that I wouldn't think about drinking, but after I stopped, I thought about it constantly, without respite or relief. Plenty of nights, I wanted to text Dave drunk, but I didn't drink anymore, so I couldn't. Instead, I texted him sober. We texted to say nothing, and by saying nothing, we also said, I am still here. Some nights, we said more. I still feel like you're my real life, I told him. Nothing else feels like my real life. I'd picked up a second job, adjunct teaching at a college 40 minutes upstate, to pay back the credit card debt on a room's worth of IKEA furniture, and to distract myself from my quiet nights with more essays to grade. My students wrote about varsity swim team politics and the acid residue of overbearing mothers, and I marked up their work with my own agendas. Gratuitous cynicism, I wrote, or irony without a point? With colleagues at this job, I had slipped into a strange set of white lies. After referring to my partner once in conversation, as if I still had one, I'd kept up the lie. It was as if I'd created a parallel universe in which Dave and I had made it work. In class, I started our discussion of Dennis Johnson's Jesus' Son by asking my students if they had a favorite story from the collection. Don't worry, I said. There's no right answer. But I was lying. There was a right answer. Their favorite story was supposed to be my favorite story, which was now Beverly Home, the only one about recovery. Johnson's narrator, Fuckhead, is working at a rehabilitation center for the elderly and disabled. He spends his evenings going to Narcotics Anonymous meetings, where sober addicts sit around collapsible tables looking very much like people stuck in a swamp. It's no postcard vision of salvation. Meetings make Fuckhead feel like a swamp creature. He's a caregiver in a rehab center full of despair. He sleeps with a woman he meets in NA who has Black Widow bad luck. The men she loves all die, from trains or car crashes or overdoses. And when Fuckhead hears about them, he is filled with a sweet pity, sad that they would never live again, drunk with sadness. He thinks, I couldn't get enough of it. The same way he'd responded to a grieving woman's scream, how he'd gone looking for that feeling everywhere. Fuckhead spends his days walking the O-shaped circuit of the rehab center with the deformed and the desperate. All these weirdos, and me getting a little better every day right in the midst of them, he says. I had never known, never even imagined for a heartbeat, that there might be a place for people like us. I read that line, the closing line of the story, aloud to my students. I read it once, twice, three times, while they quietly swept up crumbs from the donuts I'd brought to class to bribe them into loving me. On the first day of class, I'd shown up with 2 dozen donuts and a cardboard box of coffee, and then I kept bringing them each week, along with a stack of paper cups, sweeteners and creamers, plastic swizzle sticks, an anxious bouquet, afraid that if I stopped bringing them, the students would be disappointed. It was going to cost $400 over the course of the semester, more than half a month's rent, just to stave off the possibility that they'd stop liking me. There might be a place for people like us. Every voice I'd ever heard in meetings was somehow part of that closing line. Maybe some of my students found it sappy or maudlin, that sense of belonging. But my heart swelled righteously against their imagined accusations. I told myself that the students who liked the early stories best, the ones full of drugs and fever dream escapades, were still caught up in deluded fantasies of meaningful wreckage. Who knew what drugs they were doing after the end of our Friday afternoon class? One told me he'd recently discovered his totem animal during a shamanic ritual. But the students who liked Beverly Home best, they were the ones who got it. That story believed in something besides the self-immolating antics of dysfunction, their flickering, intoxicating glow. It was gazing somewhere beyond the horizon, past the blaze. One of Johnson's early drafts of Beverly Home began like this. I had sobered up just in time to have a nervous breakdown. I had no ID. I was a whimpering dog inside. Nothing more than that. Johnson first tried to dry out in 1978 in his parents' home in Tucson, where he was living with his eccentric grandmother, Mimi. But he didn't get sober for good until the early 1980s. I was addicted to everything, he told an interviewer decades later. Now I just drink a lot of coffee. Johnson was concerned about getting sober and knew this was typical of people who feel artistic, but he'd written only 2 stories and a handful of poems in 10 years while he was actively using, so he figured he didn't have much to lose. In the decade after he got sober, he produced 4 novels, 1 collection of poetry, a collection of stories, and a screenplay. His was the arc I'd been looking for, the possibility of sobriety as jet fuel. He dedicated 2 of his novels to HP, which I never would have recognized years earlier as shorthand for a higher power. He wrote The Whimpering Dog Inside, without apology or instant redemption. And every once in a while, he wrote about the consolations this dog might find. Approval was something I craved more than drugs or alcohol, he wrote in an early draft of Beverly Home. I hadn't been able to get it in the bars, but it seemed attainable in the rooms. He meant the rooms of recovery. Are we really all that tormented? Jackson had wondered. Or is it something we hang on to, foster, even cherish? In 1996, a younger writer wrote to Johnson, I want to thank you for your unfailing support and friendship in helping me get acquainted with my alcoholism. It seems there are 2 kinds of American writers, those who drink and those who used to. You introduced me to the latter. Thanks, brother. At one Thursday night meeting, I met a woman who was beautiful but fidgety, maybe mid-20s, a few years younger than me, olive-skinned, with tight jeans, a shimmery blouse, and hair in a wispy brown bun. She moved as if she were breaking a rule by inhabiting her own skin and didn't want to get caught. Her eyes had dark hollows beneath them. She kept tucking back stray wisps of hair behind her ear. At a party in Iowa, I might have been threatened by her, might have watched how she talked to men or to Dave. But in that church basement, I recognized her discomfort so immediately and strongly that it made me fidget in my seat. Shifting in her plastic chair, she spoke during the meeting about how hard it was to be in her first week, her tone clipped and uncertain. Afterward, I went up to her and introduced myself. I really connected to what you said, I told her, which was less about her words than the way she'd said them. I didn't know what to say, she said. That's part of what I connected to, I said, and the part about drinking alone. She nodded and looked down. She seemed pleased. Could I, she started, I mean, if it's not strange, I knew those pauses well, or at least my own version of them. Am I basically hurling myself on this stranger, right here in this basement? Exchange numbers, I smiled. I was just about to suggest it. Her name was Monica, and she was the first woman I ever sponsored. When she initially asked, I almost said, you might want a sponsor with a different drinking history. You might want a sponsor who knows the program better than I do. But what did I know about what she wanted? Maybe she drank like I drank. Maybe she needed to hear from me that your drinking could be boring and still pretty fucking demoralizing. Maybe she needed to hear about the program from someone who was still learning it. The first time we got together, I sat on a bar stool in Monica's kitchen, in a brick apartment complex in the suburbs with a view of a parking lot, and she told me about coming home from work and getting quietly drunk on her futon. The ghosts of those nights whispered around us, stirring her scarves, passed out on her sequined throw pillows. I wanted to help her, and I could see how much she wanted help, how much she wanted to give herself to recovery, which only made me nervous. What future can I give this woman, I wondered, as if her future were mine to give. What's the right thing to say next? So I grasped at the ladder rungs of what other people had said to me before, my own sponsors, the people I'd heard at meetings. I told her my story, what it was like, and then she told me hers. We followed the script. And honestly, it's hard to say what she would have gotten if I'd tried to reinvent it. The obsession I'd described was exactly what she'd felt, Monica said. It was what a million other people had felt, too. It wasn't anything original, our yearning. And our conversation wasn't original either. I could have been anyone, and she could have been anyone. But there we were, on our stools, in that particular Connecticut apartment, in that particular twilight. It wasn't new, our talk. It was just new for us. During those early days of sponsoring Monica, while both of us found solace in the simple fact of communion, a group of incarcerated female addicts was working a chain gang in the Arizona desert. Their guards made them chant, "We are the chain gang, the only female chain gang." They wore t-shirts that said, "I was a drug addict," or "Cleaning and sober." They lived in Tent City, a cluster of sweltering tents full of scorpions on the ground and mice in the trash heaps. Temperatures in the tents often hit 140 degrees. If I had to design a system that was intended to keep people addicted, clinician Gabor Mate told a journalist, I'd design exactly the system we have right now. João Guao, the architect of Portugal's drug decriminalization, believes the terroristic approach pioneered by Harry Anslinger, dealing with addiction by chaining, by humiliating, is the best way to make addicts wish to keep using drugs. But Anslinger's legacy has endured. Tent City was the brainchild of one of his protégés, Joe Arpaio, who was hired by the Bureau of Narcotics in 1957 and served as sheriff of Maricopa County for 24 years, from 1993 through 2016. When journalist Johan Hari interviewed Arpaio for his 2015 book, Chasing the Scream, a dizzying account of the lineage and devastating legacy of drug criminalization, Arpaio proudly showed Anslinger's signature framed and hanging on his office wall. "You got a good guy there," Arpaio said. With Tent City, Arpaio had finally, literally, made good on the dreams of the Los Angeles police officer whom Anslinger had quoted years earlier. "These people are in the same category as lepers, and the only defense society has against them is segregation and isolation whenever possible." In 2009, at a prison 22 miles west of Tent City, one prisoner, number 109416, was literally cooked alive in a cage in the middle of the desert, a bare outdoor holding cell with nothing more than a chain-link roof shielding her from the sun. She'd been sent there as punishment for a minor disciplinary infraction. Prisoner 109416 was serving time for solicitation, but her prostitution had been supporting her meth habit for years. Her addiction got her incarcerated, and it ultimately got her killed. Her body was discovered with blisters and burns all over her skin. According to one witness, her eyeballs were as dry as parchment. Her temperature was recorded at 108 degrees before she died. That was as high as the paramedics' thermometers went. Before she died in a holding cell, prisoner 109416 lived as Marcia Powell. In Chasing the Scream, Hari excavates the human particulars of her life from the dehumanizing tragedy of her death. She was a teenage runaway in California, sleeping on the beach sand for warmth and washing in McDonald's bathrooms. She was generous and drawn to bodies of water. She loved panning for gold in the lakes of Arizona. She cooked a full breakfast for her boyfriend's dog each morning, eggs and sausages. Marcia Powell died in 2009, the same year I got sober for the first time. While she was in a cage in the middle of the desert, I was getting welcomed into church basements, handed poker chips, bombarded with phone numbers. I was walking into meetings where my body was treated as valuable simply because it was in the room, simply because it was. I didn't have to march in a chain gang picking up trash tossed by commuters who'd voted for the sheriff who was making me wear a t-shirt that said, "I was a drug addict." What luck. What luck not to wake up in a cage or a 140-degree tent in the Arizona desert, not to serve time for the thrall that had already corroded me. Marcia Powell's death in the desert is another glitch in the song of my pain as private. It had been possible for that song to play seamlessly in Iowa City, where I ordered my whiskey shots in the company of mythic poets, white men serving the brutal god of their white logic. But in the world where Marcia Powell died in the desert, where Melanie Green faced a grand jury for being a pregnant addict, where Jennifer Johnson was initially convicted of delivering a controlled substance to her own child, where George Kane got a gun pulled on him in a doctor's office, where Billie Holiday died handcuffed to a hospital bed. In this world, the story of my drinking is not a private story. I used to think it was, or that it only involved me, and maybe also the men I'd been fucked by and fought with, the man who hit me on the street, the men with my last name who drank before I was born. But the story of my sadness was never just mine. It has always included strangers. Not just the strangers I met in meetings, but the strangers whose dependence had taken them to highway chain gangs rather than church basements. The strangers who weren't stopping at the Stop and Shop to pick up off-brand coffee for old-timers. My story included the woman who died in a cage in a desert, or her story included me. Not just because of my guilt, the guilt of my privilege, or my survival, but because we both put things inside our bodies to change how we felt. It's easy to forget that prisoner 109416 and I are part of the same story, because we have been granted the right to tell very different tales about our pain. According to the scripts of our culture, one of us is a victim and the other a prisoner. But keeping our stories apart, understanding them as unrelated, would ratify the logic that let our fates diverge in the first place. The desert cage, the basement chorus. Our stories are both stories about coming to depend on a substance, to crave it, seek it, use it, and I no longer want to live by the traditions that keep them apart. When I finally visited the narcotic farm in 2014, 8 decades after it opened and 15 years after it had been converted to a full-fledged prison, I found its soaring brick buildings enclosed by tangled loops of silver-barbed wire. Its aspirational architecture, cloisters and courtyards and magisterial Art Deco facades, seemed sinister beneath these ragged, gleaming coils and their brute reminder of prison's purpose, keeping punished bodies quarantined. My guide, who was in charge of media relations, used the language of rehabilitation, but it was often just as chilling as the language of punishment. Maybe he's had a couple of infractions, made a couple bad choices, he said, describing a typical prisoner deemed eligible for minimum security. But we still believe he's programmable. Programmable. The troubling descendant of an older faith in the ways an institution could rearrange someone. Since the Lexington facility had been converted to a prison, it was no longer exclusively dedicated to treating addicts, but it still had one major program committed to addiction. A 9-month residential drug abuse program known as RDAP and housed in something called the Veritas Wing. Posters invited participants to become navigators or expediters, to follow in the footsteps of cartoon men who fixed things or assisted others. The program preached the dangers of 8 major thinking errors, including indolence, entitlement, and sentimentality, which it defined as the impulse to invoke self-serving emotional excuses for one's crimes. In the community room, a converted bowling alley, I sensed the ghosts of old attempts at rehabilitation. 8,842 hours of bowling logged in 1937. Now inmates gathered in this room to give each other push-ups, compliments, and pull-ups, suggestions. The cell blocks were named after virtues, like Humility Alley, a self-contained set piece of irony that seemed to insist that the disempowerment of incarceration would grant access to virtue. "Do you still know everything?" the drug court judge had asked an addict. "Willing to listen now?" My PR guide was proud to show me all the prison's vocational facilities, the Braille workshop, where inmates designed Braille books for blind kids in pre-K, and the bare wooden frame of a house in the central open-air courtyard that got built and rebuilt by various carpentry classes, its roof beams covered with pigeon shit. It seemed strange that the birds could come and go as they pleased while the men remained. My guide proudly pointed out their very pluralist religious architecture. The Native American sweat lodge, the Wicca fire pit, the Asatru fire pit. This last one referred to with a smugly casual air, as if I would say, "Yes, of course, the Asatru fire pit." But when I asked how many Asatru inmates they'd had, I got no solid answer. Every inmate is a walking testimonial to a victim, one of the wardens told me, which I knew wasn't true, or at least not as he meant it, and seemed a sentimental thinking error of its own. The warden translated the tattoo on my arm perfectly from Latin. "I am human. Nothing human is alien to me." Then said, "Not sure it's true, though." He assured me there were prisoners who were alien to me, people who had done things so bad I couldn't possibly understand them. But I didn't believe in the same categorical divide he believed in, and I agreed with what he said only insofar as it insisted on the limits of my knowledge. I knew there was plenty I couldn't understand about the men incarcerated here, plenty I couldn't see behind the barbed wire and the scenic inmate-built gazebo, past the welding simulators and the A-frame caked in bird shit, the sweat lodge and the fire pits, past the actual and straw men victims who stood behind the fully human inmates all around me, men to whom I was not allowed to speak. I asked the education warden what he knew about the prison hospital this place had been, and he told me he knew all about it. "It had been an experiment in rehabilitation," he said, "and it failed." Instead of a cage in the desert, or a cell on Humility Alley, I got fellowship. I got to hear people describe their first drink, always so specifically conjured. It usually came out tender and liberated, like a eulogy for a bully, and carried the whiff of unfinished business in its particulars. The gleam of a whiskey bottle, the nauseating sweetness of cooking sherry, the walnut shelves or squeaky metal trolley. I was humbled, almost scared, by how sharply I remembered my own first drink at my brother's graduation party. The upholstery grain of the couch, the jutting stone fireplace, the flinty crackle of champagne. How could I remember it so well if some part of me didn't still crave it? If memory and longing were two radio dials tuned to the same frequency, then others were listening as well. A woman with multiple sclerosis named Petra said, "It was all day, every day." She talked about drinking to forget the fact of living in her ill body and the embarrassment of knocking her wheelchair into chairs and tables. But there was also something in her voice, almost wistful, that missed the escape. A woman named Lori, obese and impeccably made up, crying so hard she shook, came to a meeting drunk and said she'd once gotten drunk with her rapist after he raped her. Just this morning, she'd gotten up at 6:30 so she'd have time to buy liquor before the 7:30 meeting. I took her out to a diner afterward, where she got an Oreo milkshake, and I drank so much black coffee I thought I was going to pee for hours. She told me she tried to hit a meeting during every available spot of free time because she was afraid she might drink otherwise. And I thought, I want to help you. I don't know how. I told her about getting drunk and letting a guy finish fucking me because it was easier than stopping him. She said, "Exactly." I don't think she meant it was exactly what had happened to her, because it wasn't what had happened to her. I think she meant there was a place drinking can take you where you forget that your body even matters, and we'd both spent time there. I started giving rides to Wendy, 20 years old, the girl with a colostomy bag I'd met in a church basement across town. One morning, when I came to pick her up, she was clearly drunk, holding a huge styrofoam cup full of 7-Eleven coffee from the night before that she'd microwaved that morning, she explained in a slurred voice, because she didn't want to be wasteful. It was as if she wanted to compensate for being drunk by explaining some small thing she'd done right. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't just leave her in her driveway, or could I? The story I'd told myself about her recovery went something like this. This cool older woman started giving me rides and showed me that sobriety could be something I actually wanted. But her sobriety story wasn't mine to write. I drove her to the meeting anyway. If I understood anything that winter, I understood how difficult it could be to let go of what you loved, even if you'd decided it wasn't what you needed. It was the claw marks all over again. A few months after breaking up, Dave and I met one night at a swanky hotel on his block downtown. It was the kind of get-together where you'd say, "Let's get drinks," except we both knew I'd get a seltzer and cranberry with lime. We sat on low leather couches, in the dim light, and ordered dessert to give ourselves a reason to stay. Donuts dusted in cinnamon sugar, served alongside a ramekin of hot vanilla cream. It reminded me of the first night we'd ever kissed, how we'd stood by the kitchen sink of our friend's house for hours, refilling our cups of water, just so we could keep talking. We stayed at the hotel bar until it closed, sometime past midnight, like strangers who'd just met, like people without a history. It was recklessness without the alibi of drunkenness, running on the fuel of club soda and juice. I woke up in his bed the next morning, baked with late winter light, in his home that was not my home, under his sheets that were not my sheets. Everything that happened next happened without booze as pretext or excuse. I saw Dave sober. I slept with him sober. We ate late-night cookies from the cookie shop on his block, sober. But it didn't exactly feel sober. Before our early morning meetings, I was still going on hikes with Luke. When it got warm enough, another man I'd met in meetings took me sailing on the Long Island Sound, where I lay on the canvas mesh stretched across the bow, glazed by sun, and loved the uncluttered sense of possibility that lived in the company of someone with whom I carried no baggage, no resentment, no mistakes. When I went on early morning hikes with Luke, I kept our flirtation at a certain distance, far enough away that it wouldn't become an actual relationship, close enough to sense its glow. These times with other men were not against the rules. In those months of purgatory, Dave and I had none. But they felt selfish anyway, a way of hoarding affirmation so I wouldn't ask for more of it from Dave. I no longer believed I deserved it from him. Because I wasn't in a relationship with Dave any longer, I no longer expected as much from him. Which reminded me, in an uncomfortable way, of giving up drinking. How possible it felt to drink, once I wasn't drinking, how it shimmered in the rearview mirror. That winter, Susan and I started meeting at a downtown bistro for our sponsor meetings. The restaurant was always empty, the flagging business of a friend she was trying to support. The long tally of my second fifth step was bound up with the hush of that room in the late afternoons, the light thick and milky as cappuccino foam, the paired tastes of sweet milky coffee and french fries. So much of sobriety was full of oddly twined tastes. Mint gum and cream-filled vanilla cookies at meetings, onion rings and milkshakes and omelets on post-meeting diner runs, with everyone on different sleeping schedules, swapping bites off one another's plates. I didn't talk to Susan about the fact that I'd started seeing Dave again. It seemed messy and inexplicable and maybe unwise, what we were doing, and I didn't know how to put it in the context of my sober narrative. It was the blemish of a ragged plotline. One day, Susan told me, with real pain in her voice, that she could feel me pulling away from her. It was hard to make a date with me, and then I kept postponing them. At first, I wanted to protest. I did everything I was supposed to. I filled out everything on my inventory. But it felt good to tell Susan the truth, that I hadn't told her about things with Dave because they seemed too messy to fit inside our conversations or my step work. "That's exactly your problem," Susan told me. "You don't know how to say anything when it's still a mess inside you. You need to have everything figured out before you say it out loud." Berryman started recovery as an ode to fellowship, but the novel wasn't an account of his recovery so much as a projected vision of the recovery he never fully experienced. It was an exhortation to himself to recover better, but Berryman couldn't stay sober the whole time he was writing it. A friend of mine once observed that writing about yourself is like trying to make a bed while you're still in it. And in recovery, the lump under the sheets is palpable. Even the chapter titles expose the novel as a document of maddening repetition rather than progressive redemption. The first step is followed by the last two first steps, which is followed by dry drunk. After the first step, there's another first step, and then another first step. And after all that, Severance is somehow still a dry drunk. Berryman's marginal notes on an early draft of the novel, when he's listing the symptoms of an alcoholic, suggest that he's still reckoning with self-diagnosis. Drinking in the morning, drinking on the job, these are not the marks of a social drinker. And they testify to his relapses. Infinite resolutions, periods on the wagon, terrible remorse. As Severance confesses on the eighth page of recovery, "Sincerity was nothing in this game." 160 pages later, he says, "I have lately given up the words sincerely and honestly as mere con words designed by my diseased brain to support its lying products." He has given up on sincerity again, more than 100 pages after he gave up on it the first time. One character accidentally writes the third step prayer, "May I do thy will always," as "May I do my will always." In life, Berryman was frustrated by his relapses, but kept trying to surrender again anyway. On a slip labeled First Step, Saturday Night, he wrote, I doubt if this will be an acceptable first step, and I don't care. I doubt if any man can actually take the first step. Maybe some can, but I know I tried hard and failed. Last spring, I wrote a comprehensive account of 23 years of alcoholic chaos, lost wives, public disgrace, a lost job, injuries and hospitalization, a blacked-out call to a girl student threatening to kill her, involuntary defecation in a public place, DTs, convulsions once, etc., and it was completely sincere. And a month later, I had a slip. 4 or 5 over the next 2 months. 2 months sobriety, 5 days drinking, and here I am again. In spite of dead seriousness, never missing either an AA meeting or St. Mary's Encounter Group, and all sorts of other help, including daily prayer and the 24-hour book. So screw that first step. This is only a short, true account of my present thinking on the subject. But even as he said, screw that, he turned the paper over and scribbled a message to himself on the back. As you comb your hair and beard in the morning, say to the mirror, Berryman, God is interested in you and conscious of your struggle and your services. Good luck. He kept trying to redirect himself from crisis to purpose. Your struggle and your services. His inventories kept circling back to the same futilities and frustrations. Do I feel I'm unstoppable? Yes. Do I ever go on the wagon to prove I can quit? Yes. He didn't even mark yes or no for do I ever get drunk, as if it were a question too obvious to bear answering. His whole life had already answered it. If the novel was an attempt to write himself into recovery, Berryman's handwritten edits on the early draft betray his unresolved questions. One rehab patient looking at Severance with real interest became with the appearance of real interest. Another handwritten insertion insists that each rehab patient returns to his own world after reciting the Serenity Prayer in unison. At one point, Severance knows he felt depressed, but he can't even connect to what makes him cry. I don't know what the hell I was crying about, he says. He felt nowhere. Disappointment lurks on the other side of each dash, after the held breath of each pause. In a group therapy session near the end of the novel, Severance confesses that he has a son from whom he has been estranged for years. He's not even precisely sure of his age. 13, I think. As Severance acknowledges miserably, he doesn't know his son well, though he's not yet ready to take full responsibility for it. His letters are very childish, Severance complains. I can't find out anything about him. Berryman had an estranged son of his own, and his archives hold letters that express, as clearly as anything, the unspoken white margins of distance between them. Dear Dad, I've done well in school this quarter with a 91% average. I have enclosed a copy of my report card. I hope you like it. I've been accepted at South Kent School. This has been the only acceptance I've received so far, so I don't know if I'll be going there. Say hello to Kate and Martha for me. Much love, Paul Berryman. His letters are very childish. I can't find out anything about him. A few weeks later, Paul Berryman sent a copy of his acceptance letter from Phillips Academy, with that full name in his signature, again, as if writing to a stranger. At that point, it had been several years since he and his father had seen each other. But Berryman wanted to share the fruits of his recovery with Paul. He wanted recovery to be something that brought them closer together. Just before his birthday 1 year, Berryman wrote his son a letter. For my son, on the eve of my 56th birthday, after struggles, I think I have learned this. To give an honest, sincere account of anything is the second hardest task man can set himself. The only harder task, in my opinion at the moment, is to try to love and know the Lord in impenetrable silence. It's hardly surprising that Berryman's letter to his estranged son is all about longing for a stronger sense of connection to an estranged god, another absent father turned divine. It's also unsurprising that it's all about Berryman and his own quest. Recovery can make you self-absorbed, even as you're trying to learn otherwise, trying to reach out to neglected children or wounded spouses or an impenetrable god. By fall 1971, Berryman had given up on recovery entirely. He left the novel unfinished, and it wasn't published until after his death. He only left yellow note cards suggesting the possible endings he'd imagined. End of novel, he wrote on one. Turn this card over. On the back, he wrote, he might, certainly, at any time drink again. But it didn't seem likely. He felt calm. There it was again. That dash. Berryman was trying to imagine an ongoing state of serenity, but he could summon it only in abstract terms. On a separate note card, he wrote an alternative last page of book. On Pike's Peak, coming down, he was perfectly ready. No regrets. He was happier than he had ever been in his life before. Lucky, and he didn't deserve it. He was very, very lucky. Bless everybody. He felt fine. Berryman was clutching at the possibility of stability beyond the dash. He felt calm. He felt fine. But it's hard to trust these feelings, not only because they exist on note cards that never got used, but also because they are haunted by the dashes that came before them in the book. He felt depressed. He felt nowhere. Berryman kept his recovery notebook even after he gave up on the novel, but his final entries, from December 1971, are full of despair. Just try, he told himself. Happy a little. Grateful prayers. It got bad anyway. Terrible, continual thoughts of suicide. Cowardly, cruel, wicked. Beating them off. Don't believe gun or knife. Won't. In the unfinished novel, Severance begins his final stretch of sobriety by saying, if I don't make it this time, I'll just relax and drink myself to death. In a motel room in Hartford, Berryman wrote, it's enough. I can't bear anymore. Let this be it. I've had it. I can't wait. On January 8th, 1972, Berryman jumped off the Washington Avenue Bridge at the University of Minnesota, where he'd taught for almost 20 years, and landed on the riverbank below, dead on impact. He'd relapsed just days before jumping, after 11 months of sobriety, his longest stretch. I can't bear much more of my hideous life, Jean Reese once wrote to a friend. It revolts me, quite simply. No surprise, then, that Reese found herself wanting to write away from the eye of personal experience, the shame of thinly veiled autobiography, and into another eye who is everybody. Like Jackson, she wanted to get outside herself. This was harder when other people were around. Jean could not listen, said Selma Vazdias. She does not seem to connect. It was fiction where Reese grew closest to the consciousness of others, where she wanted to dissolve the barriers between I and everybody. And Wide Sargasso Sea, her fifth novel, the one that made her famous, was her fullest expression of this desire. Reese's first four novels had been rooted in the landscapes of her own life, dingy hotel rooms and bleak boarding houses in Paris and London. But this last one found her core wounds, alienation and abandonment, in the imagined life of someone else. Mr. Rochester's first wife from Jane Eyre, the madwoman in the attic. Reese reimagined this opaque character as Antoinette, a woman exiled from her country and spurned by a man, a life rediscovered in the wreckage, a character reclaimed from mad villainy, no resemblance to Reese at all. It took Reese nearly 20 years to write the novel, 2 decades full of poverty, binge drinking, itinerant living, and trying, often failing, to care for her increasingly ill husband, Max. She burned one draft of the novel to a crisp in her kitchen grate during a bout of drunken fury. Once she had finally completed the manuscript, she wrote to her editor, Diana Athill, "I've dreamed several times that I was going to have a baby, then I woke with relief. Finally, I dreamt that I was looking at the baby in the cradle. Such a pussy weak thing. So the book must be finished." As it happened, Max died just as she was finishing it. Athill wrote to say she'd visit as soon as she could. "I'll come armed with a bottle." The Pussy Weak story of Wide Sargasso Sea explores the unhappy marriage of Antoinette, a Dominican girl raised on a crumbling plantation, to a British second son seeking an inheritance, the young man who would become Bronte's Mr. Rochester. Wide Sargasso Sea grants a full consciousness to Antoinette, the character who appears only as a dangerous madwoman in Bronte's masterpiece, and dramatizes her destruction at the hands of a husband who doesn't love her, but brings her to England anyway and shuts her in his attic. Rhys conjures their heartache of a honeymoon as days of dislocation and estrangement spent at a crumbling old island estate, rain puddles in the red earth, steam rising off the greenery, firelight flickering across the veranda, moths dying in the candle flames. The ripe land is cruel. It deepens the sting of the couple's distance with its beauty. If the mind can make a hell of heaven, then a loveless honeymoon can make it even worse. Antoinette tries everything she can to make her husband love her more, but he can't fathom the abandonments that have whittled her need for love to such a sharp blade. After Antoinette fails at using the obeah magic of her childhood nurse to secure his affection, a pile of chicken feathers in the corner, some doctored wine, she takes refuge in the rum in the veranda sideboard. "Don't drink anymore," her husband tells her. "What right have you to tell me what I'm to do?" she replies, and keeps drinking. The rum, we understand, is little more than a poor substitute for an older magic. It grants some diluted version of the relief her nurse's obeah once offered. Her core desire is for love. Booze is just meager consolation, a sham form of sustenance. In Wide Sargasso Sea, Rhys found two vessels for empathy. She recovered the character of Mrs. Rochester, but she also imagined the psyche of the man who spurned her. The novel doesn't wonder only what it was like to be a woman imprisoned, but what it was like to be the man who'd imprisoned her. The middle section of the novel is told from Rochester's perspective, and its third portion allows his childhood governess, Mrs. F., to speak on his behalf. "I knew him as a young man. He was gentle, generous, brave." Mrs. F.'s insistence that it would be a mistake to see Rochester simply as a devil echoes Rhys's self-critiques in her imagined trial. "I do not know others," she had confessed. "I see them as trees walking." By granting Rochester a voice in the novel, Rhys allows him to emerge as something more than just another glimpsed tree, something more than a hook upon which she could once again hang her poison coat. Rochester is a symbol of abandonment turned human again, multiple and contradictory. "I am not used to characters taking the bit between their teeth and rushing away," Rhys had written to a friend as she was writing Wide Sargasso Sea. In Rochester, she imagined a man who looked like a devil but had once been a boy. And through him, she began to imagine the possibility of a gentle, generous boy in every man who'd ever looked like a devil to her. When Rochester tells Antoinette that he was forced as a young man to keep his emotions hidden, Antoinette begins to understand that almost every villain has also been a victim. If the novel reimagines villainy as the fruition of victimhood, then its ending reframes an act of destruction, Antoinette burning down Rochester's manor, as an expression of pain. In Jane Eyre, the fire is opaque and wholly threatening, the revenge of a mad lady who is as cunning as a witch. but Reese gives the mad lady an intricate psychology and exposes pain at the root of what seems like senseless self-destruction or blind malice. The fire becomes an articulate conflagration. It resurrects the manuscript from ashes in the grate where Reese drunkenly burned it. "Now at last I know why I was brought here," Antoinette says when she picks up the candle, "and what I have to do." For the last 13 years of her life, between the publication of Wide Sargasso Sea and her death in 1979 at the age of 88, Reese lived in a Devon village called Cheriton Fitzpaine, in a block of cottages called Landboat Bungalows. She was landlocked and thirsty. It was stunning that she drank as much as she drank and lived as long as she did. She told a friend that ghost stories and whiskey were the only things that brought her comfort. But technically, that wasn't true. Her bills from the liquor store J.T. Davies & Sons show that in addition to whiskey, Jameson Black Barrel and Teachers, Reese was drinking plenty of Gordon's Gin, Smirnoff, Martini Bianco, and Beaujolais. Her monthly booze bill sometimes rivaled all her other household expenses combined. By the end of her life, Reese was unable to live without assistance. In a red composition book bound with twine, her friend Diana Melly wrote a list of instructions for her various caregivers. 1. Avoid argumentative subjects like politics. 2. Never discourage her from things she wants to do with her looks, etc. For example, like buy a red wig. 3. Don't discuss age and related subjects like grandmothers. 4. Try and change the subject when things get emotional, but do it slowly. Most of Melly's instructions, however, had to do with managing Reese's daily drinking. 12 o'clock. Drink. Only when she asks for it and in a small wine glass. Lots of ice, little gin, and fill with martini vermouth. It's always the same drink, morning and evening. Don't offer another drink unless she asks for it, ever. 1 o'clock. Lunch. Pudding. Nearly always there is an ice cream in the deep freeze. Wine. If possible, not more than 2 glasses. Only if she asks. Melly crossed out those words, "if possible, not more than 2 glasses," as if admitting that any attempt to curtail might be futile. Elsewhere, she says, "Never drink anything different like whiskey in front of her, or she will want it too." If Reese demanded it, Melly suggested tiny ones with masses of ice. Reese almost always wanted them at twilight. "I stay with her then until 7 o'clock, Melly wrote, "as it is the time when she is most likely to get sad." Melly understood her friend's sadness as a type of clockwork, arriving with the dusk. It called for a drink, but what it really wanted was company. The drinking was past argument. It was less like a disease to be cured and more like a creature in the room, a wild animal that could be cajoled, with open ears, careful tongue, masses of ice, into a less ferocious version of itself. But Reese was wise to these tricks. During a visit with her friend David Plant near the end of her life, she complained that other people were always filling her drinks with too much ice. "All of writing is a huge lake," she explained to him, her metaphors getting more fluid as she got drunker. "There are great rivers that feed the lake, like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, and there are trickles, like Jean Reese." As Plant rose to leave, she asked, "Give me another drink, will you, honey? And put only 1 cube in it." During that purgatory spring, after Dave and I had broken up and then started seeing each other again, I asked him if he wanted to come hear me tell my story at a meeting. He seemed pleased and said yes. So on a chilled night in March, I picked him up in my tiny black Toyota, heat blasting as he came down to the lobby of his building. Still strange to say that. His. In a plaid scarf and dark pea coat. When I thanked him for coming, he looked me straight in the eye and told me it meant a lot to him that I'd asked. We drove to a church at the edge of town, halfway to the Dairy Queen in Hamden, a black steeple against the sky, with only its basement glowing underneath, as if a little bit of